You are listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast, focusing on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join host Joe Casey and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who created interesting second acts as they share practical ideas and tips to create your own. Check out our website at retirementwisdom.com, where you can download our newsletter and other resources to learn more about how coaching can help you. The best way to support this podcast is to head over to Apple Podcasts and post a rating and a comment. It's easy and it's free. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. If you're planning for retirement, there's a long list of things you're considering and thinking about. But what about your happiness? Our conversation today is about why that should be on your list too. It's something you can control to a great degree, and it can greatly enhance many aspects of your life. My guest today is Dr. Catherine Sanderson. She's the Poehler Family Professor and Chair of Psychology at Amherst College. She received her bachelor's degree in psychology from Stanford University and both her master's and doctoral degrees in psychology from Princeton University. Her research has received grant funding from the National Science Foundation and the National Institute of Health. Professor Sanderson has published over 25 journal articles and book chapters in addition to 4 college textbooks, middle school and high school health textbooks, as well as the Introduction to Psychology course for the Great Courses. In 2012, she was named one of the country's top 300 professors by the Princeton Review. She's written books on parenting as well as how mindset influences happiness, health, and even how long we live. In her book, The Positive Shift, Mastering Mindset to Improve Happiness, Health, and Longevity. Her latest book is Why We Act, Turning Bystanders into Moral Rebels, which examines why good people so often stay silent or do nothing in the face of wrongdoing. She also writes a weekly blog for Psychology Today called Norms Matter, which examines the power of social influence on virtually all aspects of our lives. You'll find her complete bio in the show notes. And with that, I want to welcome Dr. Catherine Sanderson. Thanks so much for joining us.
I'm so glad to be here to talk. Thanks for the invitation.
So in your work, how did you first become interested in positive psychology and the study of happiness?
Well, to be honest, I probably came to it very naturally because I'm not particularly a happy person. So one of the key findings from the research of positive psychology is that some people are predisposed to be happier, sort of have an easier time finding the silver lining. And I am really decidedly not one of those people. So when I went to graduate school, you know, way back when, no one was really talking about positive psychology. It was really not an issue. But in my teaching and my research at Amherst College over the last 24 years, there's been this tremendous wave in the field of psychology that really focuses on how you can become happier. So in my own teaching and my own research, I became really interested in this topic of, wait, how do we change our mindset to become happier? And I really resonated on it, I think, on sort of a personal level. And so that was really the start, that in my own research and teaching and writing and talking, I became really fascinated by how much control we did have over the ability to be happier.
So you mentioned mindset. How does our mindset influence us?
So on some level, we've all known, and in fact, everyone listening right now is going to recognize some of the profound ways in which mindset matters. So we've all heard of the placebo effect. If I, you know, give you a sugar pill and I say, oh, this is, you know, Advil or Excedrin or, you know, Tylenol, all of a sudden, oh, my headache, you know, feels better. That's an example of mindset. So we've all heard about mindset. One of my favorite examples, actually, I read in a letter to the editor in the New York Times Magazine, and here was their example of mindset. When you're a little kid and you know, fall off a slide or skin your knee and you say, please, you know, can you kiss it and make it better? And, you know, the parent does. And then in fact, the kid says, oh, I do feel better. That is an example of mindset. So what's funny is that we all intuitively know that mindset matters. But what we now know increasingly in research and medicine and psychology and neuroscience is that mindset, our thought patterns, how we think about something, actually has a tremendous influence on, you know, pain, on mood, on relationships, and really on all aspects of our lives. And that's what I think is so exciting. and so applicable in all of our daily lives, that our mindset, our thought patterns, our expectations actually exert a tremendous influence on almost everything.
So what predicts happiness?
Well, there's kind of some good news and some bad news. So I'll say that the bad news for some of us, again, present company, is that there seems to be a pretty strong genetic link. So about 50% of our happiness seems to be built in terms of our genes. And this means that some people have a genetic predisposition to feeling happier. Now, it's not as simple as like the happiness gene, that there seems to be a constellation of different genes that predispose somebody to being in part more resilient when things don't go well, but also probably predisposed to seeing the bright side, finding that silver lining, you know, no matter what happens. And so about 50% of our happiness, in fact, is determined by our genes. But thinking about it positively, that also means that about 50% of our happiness is not influenced by our genes. And that's the part that I care about the most. And what this research says is that, in fact, about 50% of our happiness is determined by things that we do. So this could be something as simple as exercising, spending time in nature, giving to other people, building good relationships. So there are things that we can all do in our daily lives that also predict happiness.
So that genetic component is interesting, 50%. And you mentioned in your book, The Positive Shift, that we're naturally either like Tigger or Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh. Can Eeyores become Tiggers?
Ooh, I love that question. So I don't think that Eeyores can become Tiggers, because I think I'm kind of an Eeyore and I would, you know, love to have that Tigger mindset. However, I think that Eeyores can train themselves and can exert some effort to adopting some of the Pooh-like magical thinking and optimistic vibe. So I don't think you can become a Tigger, but I think you can say, wait, what are Tiggers doing that really pays off? And can I kind of practice that and exert some effort to become more like that, even if it's not my natural predisposition?
So you can emulate certain behaviors, certain qualities, certain behaviors.
I would say certain behaviors and also certain thought patterns. So I think one of the key characteristics of the Eeyore is this sort of tendency to wallow in doom and gloom. Oh my gosh, you know, things are going to go terribly. Things are going to go poorly. I am the mom of three, a son who's recently graduated from college, another son in college, and a daughter in high school. And pretty regularly, if I haven't heard from them, you know, in a few days and I text them and there's not a response, I can easily kind of spiral into, are they lying dead in a gutter or, you know, whatever. And instead it'll be like, yeah, I lost my cell phone charger, or yeah, I was just really busy. So there's an example in which like I can sort of naturally go to the dire emergencies. And so can Eeyores become more like Tiggers? I think basically Eeyores can practice, okay, wait, is that really a realistic fear that I have? Or am I sort of catastrophizing in some way? And so I think what Eeyores can do is they can actually exert some effort in terms of their behaviors, in terms of their thoughts that help them feel happier and probably, frankly, healthier. Now, I think the distinction, and this is, I think, an important distinction, is that what Winnie the Pooh and the sort of optimistic, happy people do naturally, Eeyores have to exert some effort. So I have to sort of step back and say, okay, wait, I have to think about realistically, you know, should I be concerned? I guess I often sort of look at it as the role of metabolism. So I have a younger brother, and my younger brother has an amazing metabolism. He can eat anything at any moment and never gain any weight. And that's not true for me. So I have to say, okay, I need to be conscious of making sure I'm making healthy food choices. I have to be conscious of making sure I'm getting in some exercise in order to stay healthy. And so I guess I look at the Eeyore Pooh distinction in that way, that maybe Eeyores can't become Poohs. They can't naturally do this, but they can remind themselves and they can train themselves to engage in certain behaviors and thought patterns that help them feel happier and healthier.
So does money buy happiness?
Well, this is one of the most controversial questions, I have to be honest, in psychology right now. And depending on which day you ask me, there might well be a recent study. So for many years, it was assumed that money could not buy happiness. There was a pretty famous study that was done by Nobel Prize winning psychologist Daniel Kahneman at Princeton that produced a very famous study saying above making about $75,000 a year, you actually don't experience an increase in well-being. There's actually a very recent study that came out that suggests that's actually wrong. that people actually do experience increased well-being as their income increases. So I have to be honest, I think the jury is still a little bit out on this, but I think there's two really key points of information. One, what we do know very consistently is that people adapt and they adapt to newfound wealth. And so you might think, oh, if I just had another 5,000, you know, then I would be happier. But then you get that raise and all of a sudden you're like, okay, but if it was just a little bit more, you know, then I would be happier. And so I think one of the challenges that we all have is that we adapt to newfound circumstances. And that can be financial well-being, but it can also be weather, it can be a better cell phone, you know, it can be all these different kinds of things. I think it's also the case that with greater financial well-being, people actually can buy themselves out of certain things. So if there are things that are making you feel stressed, having to clean your house or having to cook dinner or needing to buy a flight that has, you know, lots of bad layovers instead of a more expensive direct flight, there are ways in which more financial well-being can actually buy us out of some stress, and that in fact can increase well-being.
So it's the hedonic treadmill.
Exactly. It is the hedonic treadmill. And again, I'm old enough that I can remember getting my first cell phone, and that first cell phone could call people, like maybe, but it was still really exciting because you could call people from the car. Some of your younger listeners might be like, I have no idea what she's talking about now about that kind of a cell phone. But of course, now we've all adapted, right? We've all adapted on the hedonic treadmill in that we think our cell phones should be able to let us shoot a movie, read a book, buy a dress, you know, et cetera. And that's an example of this, the power of adaptation, which is a very, very consistent finding in the literature.
You also make some interesting points in your book about time and money and how to value and use each of those and which is more important. We'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I really find this research fascinating. And what this research is really illustrating is that it's not so much how much money you have, but it's really how you choose to spend your time. And that people who make choices that are saying, I'm going to spend money to save some time, actually experience higher levels of happiness. And that often, I think, is kind of counterintuitive. So I grew up in a family that, you know, was not particularly well off. You know, my parents were highly conscious of what we were spending. And they both came from families historically in their own lives that had really struggled with money. So we made sort of lots of choices that were, all right, you know, we're going to have a sort of, you know, bad layover that, you know, that's not very pleasant when we went on vacation. So we go on vacation, but, you know, we were going to do it the sort of cheaper way in a sense. And I think that what this research is now showing, you know, very strongly is that people who make choices that are saving themselves time. So, okay, you know, we're going to take the more expensive flight, but we're going to have 10 more hours in Paris, you know, or whatever. We're not going to spend, you know, 6 hours in the Amsterdam airport or whatever, actually are experiencing higher levels of happiness. And what I think is important on a really practical level is that there are times in which, you know, my husband and I will say, all right, you know what? We're going to get takeout. We're going to get takeout because we just do not have time to cook and clean and wash the dishes, et cetera. So, you know, we're going to get takeout and it's going to be a little bit more expensive, but we're going to really enjoy the 2 hours that we get to spend together instead of the time that we spend doing other things. One of my favorite findings in that research as well is that we get more benefit out of spending money on experiences than belongings. So I think the idea that buying somebody an experience, you know, tickets to a Broadway show or a trip or tickets to, you know, the Major League Baseball game or whatever, that we anticipate that experience, we experience that experience, and we reflect back on that experience. And that's, again, another way about, it's not how much money we have, but kind of how do we spend that money, that's very, very strongly predictive of increased happiness.
So you get to relive it, anticipate it, live it, relive it. So it really is three times or more.
Three times. No, and I'll say, I share an example from the book that I think is really demonstrates this finding is that, and again, it's about my brother. He lives in Chicago. He's been a longtime season ticket holder for the Chicago Cubs, which for years has been a money losing endeavor, as Cubs fans will resonate with. But a few years ago, a miracle happened. The Cubs were in the World Series, and he called me and said, "What should I do with my playoff tickets?" And specifically, it was that he had four seats, and every game, if he sold the tickets, he would make $10,000. That was the going rate for four tickets. And I said, he said, "Well, what should I do?" And I said, "Well, according to research in the science of happiness, you should do one of two things. You should either go to a game, enjoy it, you know, with your wife and two kids, or you should sell the tickets and take a wonderful trip, you know, go to Disney or, you know, go to California or something. What you shouldn't do is buy new living room furniture." And that, I think, exactly is what the research on the science of happiness would say. So what they ended up doing for one of the games is they, in fact, sold the tickets. He shared the tickets with other people, so he only got to go to one game. But they went to a game, and he anticipated going. They were so excited. They went. They actually saw the only winning game in Wrigley Field. And they, of course, got a picture of it. They reflect back on that. It was, you know, their holiday photo card. And, you know, his son got a game ball, miraculously. And it was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And so that sort of epitomizes what we know about the choice between how you spend money and spending it on experiences sort of leads to lasting benefits.
And you mentioned baseball, and that's a great story and a great ballpark, obviously. But it reminds me of another thing you brought up in your book, a research study about baseball cards and smiles.
Well, I love that example. Thank you for that question. So this was a fascinating study. And what the researchers did using archival data was they examined professional baseball players' rookie baseball cards. And they looked at specifically the smile on their rookie baseball cards. And they found, of course, that, you know, some men had big beaming smiles. Some men had sort of slight smiles. Some men had, you know, really flat, you know, neutral expressions, no smile at all. So what the researchers did then is look at these men and they examined how old they were when they died. So using large swaths of archival data, and what they found was fascinating, that men who had a big beaming smile on their rookie baseball cards actually lived longer than men who had a slight smile or a flat expression. So what I love about that study is it really illustrates the power of having a positive outlook on life, again, as measured by the degree of smiling on your rookie baseball card, again, years ago. And it really illustrates that smiling probably doesn't just make us feel good, you know, happy in the moment, but it may, in fact, actually add years to our lives, which is really a fascinating finding.
I can only imagine what those baseball cards are worth today.
Yes, hopefully people saved many of those cards, and that indeed might make somebody very happy.
Yes, absolutely. So one thing I hear a lot of is some people think they'll automatically be so much happier when they finally get to retire. But in listening to you and reading your work, you caution people about linking external events and happiness. What should we all know about that?
Oh, I love that question. So I think that the challenge is that people often think, I will be happy when. And the when varies. So it could be, I'll be happy when I get married. I'll be happy when I have a child. I'll be happy when I retire. I'll be happy when I buy a house, you know, whatever. That we often think of happiness being around the corner instead of happiness being something that we can actually control in our own lives. So what the research shows is that for some people, retirement actually can be really hard because they might lose a sense of a social network. They might lose, you know, the sense of colleagues at the office. They might lose a sense of purpose and their sort of success in terms of, oh, here I am producing things in a way. And so what I think the lessons from positive psychology really tell us is that we actually control what the retirement is for ourselves. And what do we know about how to successfully retire? Well, basically the things that predict happiness throughout our lives, having meaning, building relationships, choosing how you allocate your time. So people who retire and retire effectively actually find ways of creating meaning and building relationships in retirement. So that could be saying, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to retire from my job, but I'm going to continue to consult, or I'm going to do volunteer work in my community. I'm going to do things that, again, give me meaning that I haven't had the time to do earlier in life. And this is going to be really meaningful. For some people, that could be writing a book. For some people, that could be gardening. For some people, that could be tutoring or mentoring or consulting with nonprofit organizations. Again, using the skills that you developed in your professional life as a way of giving back to younger colleagues or in your community or in other sorts of volunteer organizations that you care about. It's also really important for people in retirement to make sure they are actively building relationships. That could be maintaining relationships with former colleagues, but it could also be establishing new relationships with friends, with neighbors, with family members. And again, it doesn't matter who those relationships are with. What matters is that we know relationships are a tremendously important aspect of our lives, and building and maintaining good relationships in retirement may require a little bit of extra effort because you don't just go to the office and see everybody. In some ways, of course, we've all had to work on developing those kinds of skills during the coronavirus pandemic, in which many people, you know, couldn't go to the office and see people, or many people couldn't, you know, go to school and see people or other environments. So in a sense, the coronavirus pandemic has given us a chance to practice, how do I develop skills in terms of maintaining and building relationships with people, even when I can't actually see them and interact with them in my day-to-day life.
Such a great point. And you mentioned that it takes effort, it may take some extra effort. And it sounds like that's a good summary for all of you. You've written about happiness. It takes effort and we can control a lot of this.
Yeah. In fact, that might be the single most important point, I think. I'm so glad that you raised that. I think that actually is the most important finding from the field of positive psychology, that I believe many people think that happiness happens to us, right? We win the genetic lottery. We win the actual lottery. You know, we become a millionaire or, you know, whatever. That happiness happens to us. It happens upon us. And yes, your point exactly is that for many of us, maybe even most of us, happiness involves effort. It involves effort during times of life transition. It involves effort for people who are not naturally sort of predisposed to be happy. And yes, the key thing about that effort means that it's not something that happens to us. It's something that happens because we decide it's important. We decide we care about being happy. We decide we deserve to be happy. And we have to then make deliberate choices to spend time and energy and effort in ways that will bring us happiness. Exactly.
So you mentioned before about the placebo effect and mindset. I was wondering, how do people's views on aging affect how we actually age?
Yes. Ooh, what an important topic. So really sadly, within the United States, and I want to be clear about contextualizing it because it really is within the United States, there is a very negative view about aging, that with aging comes, you know, wrinkles and arthritis and, you know, all of these sorts of, you know, gray hair and all these sorts of negative things. And as soon as you have a negative outlook on aging, it actually leads you to age less well. And in a sense, it's kind of buying into negative stereotypes that can become a negative mindset and in fact can create the negative reality that you're expecting. So this is not seen in other cultures. So in many cultures, Asia in particular, people look at aging as people who with age become full of wisdom and life experience. A lot of the Italian culture focuses in this as well. So one of the keys, I think, is really adopting a positive mindset about aging, that aging is a time in which you are free to pursue things. You are free to do new things. You are full of wisdom and life experience. And adopting that positive mindset about aging is really an important way of aging better, happier, healthier, better relationships, and so on.
So you mentioned earlier, too, that this doesn't necessarily come naturally to you. And I'm curious, how do you apply what you know about happiness based on the research in your day-to-day life?
So I'll tell a very personal anecdote, which is that shortly after the coronavirus pandemic hit, so March of 2020, I was really spiraling. And I was sitting up at night on my phone, Googling like symptoms of coronavirus. Like, do I have it? How many ventilators are there available in my community? You know, what are the outbreak, you know, numbers in my county and all this stuff? And so I was really spiraling, you know, coronavirus, lack of control and certainty, really, you know, not my forte. And then something fascinating happened. I started getting people reaching out to me. Some people emailed me. I remember getting a couple of physical letters like in my actual mailbox. And they were people who I didn't know. They were strangers. And what they would say, there would be people who had read my book, The Positive Shift, or had heard me talk about happiness at, you know, a one-day university or other kind of event. So these strangers would reach out to me and they would say, I just want you to know that I'm so thankful for your book, or I'm so thankful for your talk. It's such a sense of solace and comfort to me during these days of the coronavirus pandemic. I remember one woman in particular, I think she lived in maybe North Carolina or Florida. And she said, every day I open up your book at a page at random and I read that page and it always gives me something reassuring. So as I'm spiraling, I'm getting all of these outpourings of people. And more or less, I'm like, I should read that book. That sounds really helpful. And what it was all of these people who were doing exactly, of course, what I told them to do, adopt a positive mindset, et cetera. And so here's what I did. I was like, you know what? I've really got to start putting this into practice. And so here's what I did. And it was really profoundly meaningful to me. I did a few things. One, my husband and I started doing something called the 6-minute workout, which you can Google it if you don't know what it is, but it's literally 6 minutes. And it's exercising. My husband and I also started walking with our dogs every day in our neighborhood. Because of course, I couldn't go to the gym. I'd been going to the gym my whole life. I couldn't go to the gym. The gym was closed. And so I started thinking about exercise. I started thinking about deliberately exercising in my life. I started thinking about spending time in nature. I also printed out on a piece of paper, a calendar of all the days of each month, you know, April and May, whatever. And I would write the name of a friend on each day, a friend or my cousin or, you know, somebody. And I would say, that day I'm going to call them or I'm going to email them. I'm going to text them. I'm going to reach out. And so what I really tried to do was to say, okay, the things that normally I was doing in my day-to-day life, I couldn't do because of the coronavirus pandemic. So here's what I'm going to do. Here's how I'm going to exercise. Here's how I'm going to spend time in nature. Here's how I'm going to reach out to a friend, et cetera. And to me, that was sort of an example of, it was not easy or natural for me to sort of adopt this positive mindset of, oh, I'm going to use the pandemic to learn how to make sourdough starter or learn how to speak Italian or, you know, learn how to play the guitar or all these things that people were talking about on social media. I had to exert effort to say, here's what I'm going to do to be okay during this time. And so again, for me, I look at the lessons from the field of positive psychology all the time, and it's made a real and profound difference in my life.
As a parent, our youngest daughter, who's now 23, was born right around the time that the Optimistic Child book came out by Martin Seligman. And so that made a big impact because just really some of those things that we've planted seeds about back then, you can see in spades. She's definitely one of our most strongest takers, whether it be genetic or the influence from the book. So there are so many things we can do, take ownership of happiness, and mention so many behaviors which are so doable already. But there are things that get in the way. What do you think gets in the way of happiness? Things we should avoid?
So I think one of the keys, and you know, I too have a 23-year-old son. I think one of the things that gets in the way of happiness for many of us, and I think this is particularly true for, you know, college students, for adolescents, for young adults, is social media. I think that social media can often be sort of a rabbit hole of, oh my gosh, everybody else is succeeding and they're living their best lives and they look good and they have all these friends and they're, you know, they're doing great things and they're running the New York City Marathon and all this stuff. And I think that social media for many people can force a kind of comparison that really does get in the way of happiness. There's a great quote that actually is the title of one of my book chapters, which is a Teddy Roosevelt quote, "Comparison is the thief of joy." And as I often say to my own children, I, in many ways, am lucky that I am old enough to have never had to look at photos of parties I was not invited to while I was in high school and college. Because that didn't happen, right? Nobody posted on Instagram when I was in college. There was no Instagram. And so I think about that a lot as a mom, that the presence of social media forces a kind of comparison that those of us who are fortunate to be older didn't have to experience. And so I think for many people in general, but I think for adolescents and young adults in particular, social media can really be harmful in terms of finding happiness.
So for people listening who want more happiness and who doesn't, what are a few practical tips you'd offer them?
So I actually end my book in the very final section by talking about strategies. And it's my very favorite part of the book because I think it's so hopeful to know that happiness is within reach of all of us. Now, I also will point out that I don't think happiness is one size fits all. So sometimes people say, well, you know, I really don't like to meditate or, you know, I don't like to exercise or, you know, I don't like to read or whatever. And you know what? That's okay. Because happiness, I think, is very individual. But there are three very consistent findings in the literature, and I'm going to throw those out because these are things that just time and time again, empirical evidence, correlational, experimental, you know, descriptive, cross-cultural, et cetera, provide support for. Number one, spending time in nature. So as I'm talking to you right now, I'm actually looking out my office window and I'm looking at a little garden and some trees. I mean, I'm also looking at buildings, but I'm looking at the sky and I'm looking at nature. And I love this view because it really does force me to sort of look up. As I'm talking to you, I can see. If you were to turn around, you would see nature all around, right? I mean, you're clearly talking from a beautiful environment. I can see flowers, you know, right behind you and so on. So for many people, spending time in nature. And as this example that I just gave, you and I are not in nature as we're having a conversation, but we both have the opportunity to look at nature. So any kind of nature matters. It can be looking at nature. It can be being in nature. It can be actually having pictures around your office or your home or plants inside. It can be listening to audio tapes or CDs of birds chirping or waves crashing or whatever. But so things that put us in nature overwhelmingly increase psychological and physical well-being. Two, giving. And giving is so broad. Giving can be donating blood, donating bone marrow. It can be donating to charity, you know, financially. It can be spending time volunteering for an organization you care about. So giving is very broadly construed. I have a dear friend who is undergoing treatment for cancer right now. And yesterday she had another chemotherapy session. And what I'm doing is that every day on the day of her chemo, I'm sending flowers. So I had flowers delivered to her house yesterday. And it's a tiny little thing that I'm doing, but I'm doing it because it's a little tiny way of giving to somebody who's really undergoing a hard time. And so giving can mean lots of different things. It can mean flowers, you know, blood, time, you know, money, whatever. But giving is a very, very consistent way of finding happiness. And then the third thing, so nature is one, you know, giving is one. And the third thing, and this is true for all of us, relationships. Building and maintaining good relationships is so important for all of us. And this can be relationships with family members. It can be relationships with romantic partners. It can be relationships with colleagues. It can be relationships with neighbors. It can be relationships with friends. But the single best predictor of our happiness is building and maintaining good relationships. And we can all take steps to do that, no matter who we are.
Well, I know you had all those letters and emails where people being thankful. And I just wanted to say I'm very thankful for your book, for your One Day University talk, especially for spending time with all of us today, because it's hugely helpful, a lot of practical advice and evidence-based, and really appreciate you taking the time to do it.
Well, I think as you and your listeners can tell, I love talking about psychology. And so thank you for this opportunity to talk. This has been a highlight of my day, a day that I'm mostly spending grading papers. So thank you for this little interruption in my sea of papers that I'm reading. And I hope that you and your listeners got some good tips they can use. As I often say, we all benefit from living in a world with more happy people. So I'm glad to play a little tiny role in helping to create more happiness around us.
Well, thanks again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I've been a coach for 12 years, but before that, I spent 30 years in HR. And I heard my share of complaints. Not once did I hear anyone complain, "I'm just too happy. There's too much happiness. I can't take it anymore." So we can all benefit from a lot of lessons we learned from Dr. Sanderson in the conversation today. Here are a few takeaways. First, it takes some effort. Many of the strategies listed in our book are excellent, in my opinion and experience, but it's worth it. The effort's worth it because of the impact it'll have on your health, your well-being, and perhaps your longevity. But not all of them take extraordinary effort. In fact, most of them. Remember her story about the baseball cards, those rookie cards, and the smiles. That's something we can all do more. Remember to smile more. My wife has written a quote from Mother Teresa on our blackboard near the kitchen area. Never underestimate the power of a smile. Something to think about today and in the days ahead. Second, how we think really matters. And it matters how we think about aging. It influences how we may actually age. So think about how you're thinking about aging. Are you approaching it through the lens of positive aging, as she had mentioned? Are you looking at it as an opportunity to do new things? Or are you letting the pervasive ageism around us all really get to you and affect how you're thinking about it? So check your thinking about aging and how can you adopt a positive aging stance toward that. And third, take some action on the three strategies you recommended. There are many others in a book, great ones, but these three are all actionable. Spend some more time in nature or around nature. Do something for others. As she mentioned, there's a lot of different ways of giving, volunteering and giving time, make donations, random acts of kindness. Do something for someone in the week ahead and see what it does, not only for them, but for you. And while you're at it, a bonus takeaway, avoid comparisons. Forget about keeping up with the Joneses. It's time to graduate from that. Focus on your own happiness. The Joneses will have a hard time keeping up with you. Thank you for listening to the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can browse all of our episodes on our website, retirementwisdom.com. You'll find topics and interesting guests that I think you'll benefit from here. We're starting our next Designing Your Life group program in mid-January. If you're interested, give me a call. You can schedule a call on our website, retirementwisdom.com, and talk about the program or the one-on-one coaching that I do, if it's of interest to you, to help you write your new story. Looking forward to talking with you again next week.
Thank you for joining us today on the Retirement Wisdom Podcast. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.